When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the Rocks Back Pages podcast. I'm Barney Hoskins, and sitting with me in a rather noisy Hammersmith are Mark Pringle.
Hi, Barney.
And Jasper Morrison Bowie.
Hello, Barney.
And we're joined for this episode by the excellent Chris Roberts, former mainstay of Sounds and Melody Maker, author of books on ABBA, Talk Talk, and most recently The Velvet Underground, and an actual musician to boot. Welcome, Chris.
Hi there, good to be here.
We're going to talk to you today about your career and about Radiohead and Missy Elliott. But let's start where we usually start, which is, was there one record or musical experience or moment that caused you to sell your soul to rock and roll?
I think, like a lot of people my generation, Ziggy Stardust and T-Rex, Metal Guru, that kind of 1972, 1973, were when the scales fell from your ears, as they were, and, you know, music became this wonderful other planet that you had to visit. Then as for getting into the writing of it, I was early 80s, mid 80s, unemployed, and it seemed like a good thing to try to do. I did an on-spec review of Iggy Pop at the venue and sent it to all the papers, and all of them got back the next day to my surprise. I mean, I was signing on at the time, so I was delighted. I can't remember why I went with Sounds at that time, but I did. And happily ever after from there, of course, without any hiccups along the way whatsoever.
It sounds like you might have sat there and, like, representatives from all the major weeklies. So you go, well, I think...
A bidding war,
exactly. Well, I mean, that's good. Well, I mean, had you read the music press avidly before that?
Yes, yeah, big fan. I think for a lot of us at that time, it was kind of your cultural education or entertainment, as much as any lecturers at university or anything else was. You would read the music press religiously, you know, and it was then, it wasn't just about music. You would be tipped off about films or books or arts all kinds of high-flown references were brought in.
Yeah. Which do you read?
I think I dabbled. I flirted promiscuously between all of them.
The reason why I ask is because The Enemy was the one which had the broadest remit in terms of outside, beyond pop music culture.
Yeah, film
and
stuff.
And politics.
Writers and politics.
And so on and so forth.
I think The Enemy was the hip name at that time.
Sure.
I like to think that later when I worked for Melody Maker that we
it wasn't anymore. Yeah, that's funny. I've never heard anyone say they flirted promiscuously between the music.
Contradictory.
Between Record Mirror and Disc Music Echo.
Well, were any of them hurt?
Depended on who was
by
on
your the, by your
dalliances.
Your affair.
It depended who was on the cover, I suppose, a lot of the times. If it was a band you liked, if I was into the Bunny Man and the Sound and the Comstock Angels, you know, I just wanted to get in the Sound of the Comstock Angels there because they don't always get as mentioned as the Bunny Man Brothers. But I was a big Paul Morley fan, I must be honest.
Well, I think that's the first and the last.
Comstock Angels.
Next week, it's a Comstock Angels special.
Good. My work here is done.
yes. I'll get me code. So, were there any particular writers that you say influenced you?
I mean, the more pretentious, the better. So Paul Morley was my favourite, Ian Penman, you know, these kind of guys. But I remember a writer called Giovanni De Doma. Sounds, who I used to like very much.
We have him on RBP.
Great, yeah. These were the more pretentious, the more a review would not mention the album, the more it would say, I'm in the bath looking at the ceiling, and then maybe mention the album for 2 seconds at the end. Loved it. It seemed like beatnik poetry. It seemed like jazz writing. It was kind of, to my generation of Stone students, it seemed like, you know, the way forward.
I read a very largely impermanent piece against pop music, which I proofread, which is going to the library, I think, maybe next week. And I have to say, I didn't understand a word he was saying. It was extraordinary. It really took me back to, like, 1981, not understanding a word Ian Penman was saying. He's now turned into an exemplary. I mean, his stuff at London Review of Books is just brilliant.
It's absolutely wonderful. But, maybe after the episode, Chris could explain
this piece. You can read it and translate it kind of paragraph by paragraph.
We're going to get in that. Just about the rest of the episode. An analysis. So you were, what was the culture like at Sounds, as a matter of interest?
I went there, it was quite a heavy metal mag at the time, quite a hard rock mag. And I think I amused them like this weird animal that wandered into a forest of lions, like this little sort of bush baby, wide-eyed thing that was writing and saying all these things that didn't fit with Sounds at all. And that amused them, I think. And they would send me to review Black Sabbath or Donington or whatever, and I would come back and slag it off because that's what I thought you did. And I would get lots of hate mail, and they loved this. They loved the feedback, I think.
You say they, who...
Sorry, the Sounds...
What I mean is the particular editors or who... Who was amused?
It was... the reviews editor was a quite fearsome woman called Robbie Miller.
Right.
Who you did not upset or cross. One glare from her and you were shaking. And if you're 5 minutes late, because these are the days where you went in with your copy on Tippex paper, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
If you're 5 minutes late, you felt like the headmaster was, you know, giving you serious detention. Gary Bushell was there at the time, who was always very nice to me, I must be honest. And
Jeff Barton, I guess, would still have been there, the father of heavy metal.
That's right, and there was all kind of lots of striped trousers and leather blues on jackets and this kind of thing.
Yes.
Again, I was a complete fish out of water, but for a couple of years, it was very good. I kind of, at that age, you want to make a name for yourself, you want to make a splash. So I was writing, you know, willfully, preposterously controversial things, you know, like Bon Jovi are the worst band I have ever seen, or, you know, whatever it was, just to get feedback, which served its purpose, I suppose, and got me noticed. You know, I'll be upfront and honest about that. I was trying to get noticed, and cool. I was.
You wrote quite a lot about hip-hop. According to, you know, our...
Even at Sounds.
Right, I mean, the first few pieces that we have are many of them are hip-hop or like R&B pieces for Sounds, which obviously was not paper.
Which would make you almost unique at Sounds, because Sounds probably wrote about black music less than any of the Incas.
It was very incongruous, but it is a fact, a statistic. Yes, I think we were one of the first covers. We did a cover on hip-hop in general. My friend and I, who wasn't really a professional photographer, went down to Covent Garden, where there were all these b-boys dancing.
Yeah, yeah.
And where...
the birthplace of hip-hop.
Forget the Bronx. Covent Garden.
Downtown Covent Garden, you know, where the streets get real. Yeah. But we covered that. We took some shots, didn't interview some of those guys. And I think for the same issue or thereabouts, we interviewed Houdini and Africa Bambaataa, I think, and a couple of others, Morgan Khan at Street Sounds, perhaps. And
you did a big piece about Street Sounds.
Championed that among the early adopters, probably, safe to say, yeah. The readers weren't that keen at Sounds, but the editors knew that in advance, and they made a conscious decision to, we will open our doors to this, to their credit. You know, we know it won't be our best-selling issue. We know the readers generally won't love it, but it will, long-term, bigger picture, it'll probably be a good move for us.
So, Chris, what led to your defection to Melody Maker? What happened there?
They came and wooed me. It sounds awfully arrogant that I was making a splash for myself. I seem to keep saying that, but I was.
damn it!
Mission accomplished. And I kind of knew that Sounds wasn't the ideal home in the end. You know, there was a lot of it was kind of Aussie is God kind of things, which wasn't my turf. But, and I wanted to be, as I say, my idols had been the Morleys, the Penmans, the you know, would-be intellectual, let's say, writers. And so Melody Maker came, NME came as well, But at that time, it was very weird, because I remember going to the pub with the then Melody Maker editors, and they were having to persuade me, and I was going, well, I don't want to come in every day, and I want a salary, and I want expenses for this. I mean, just preposterous things that these days people cannot believe how it was.
Yeah, you'd be grovelling, you'd be on the floor.
Yeah.
No, you'd be working for free.
You'd be working for free. Please let me work for free.
I mean, there were, when I became a staff writer there, there were three staff writers at the Maker at the time, which were the very excellent Simon Reynolds and David Stubbs and myself. You know, nowadays for a magazine of any type to have three staff writers would sound like luxury of the highest order.
I mean, it's very interesting that you arrived at Melody Maker just as it was kind of emerging, becoming the strongest in many ways they've been since the late 60s, I'd say. I'm with Stubbs and with Reynolds, that the paper was really changing. If you go from like 1984 Melody Maker to 1986, 87 Melody Maker, they're quite different beasts.
Yeah.
They really are.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there are a lot of the same writers still there, but the paper has changed and has become really quite substantial in a way that, you know, and very much Reynolds and Stubbs sort of driven, I'd say.
I think when Alan Jones, as editor, was encouraging new writers to break forth, he wanted a new generation to take over. I think.
But I mean, it was, you know, but really serious writing, which was really for me. I mean, because I wasn't as an NME reader at the time. My job, Roxback Pages, is actually you can kind of see that quite clearly as a sort of a change in the paper.
Mm, yeah,
interesting.
Yeah.
I want to ask you very briefly, just a tangent, about Icon magazine. Because I met with Jonathan White. It was a peculiar thing, wasn't it? It didn't last very long. But you did interview David Bowie for Icon. Were you the editor? I mean, you were the editor, weren't you? That's what I'm recalling.
It was short-lived.
Yeah, I think I was being interviewed for that position, and I think you got the job.
Oh, I didn't know that.
But as it turns out, it's probably a good thing I didn't, because it didn't last very long.
It was strange. I mean, he I went to meet him. He offered very good money at the time.
Yes, I'll be honest. It was quite good money.
Yeah. So I don't regret taking it, you know. And it was I was allowed to choose my own team of, you know, deputy editor, features editor, etc. And it was in a nice office in Kensington. And we were told, yes, it's going to be monthly, you know, music and arts and film.
It was a glossy monthly magazine, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's right, yes. And it seemed too good to be true. And ultimately it was, because the company didn't seem to know what they were doing. They'd never been involved in publishing. After a couple of issues, they were starting to say, you must do this, you must do that. The initial freedom we'd been promised was being, you know, editorial control was being taken away, which kind of came to a head when I think the fifth or sixth issue, which would be the last one, I wanted Martin Scorsese on the cover. They insisted Patsy Kensit must be on the cover. No disrespect to Patsy, but it was a different kind of headspace to, you know, what we've been hoping for.
Patsy's had a much more impressive career.
And her films, you know, like Lethal Weapon 2 or whatever, that beats the hell out of Casino. But the company didn't really know what they were doing in the end. They didn't have any publishing experience. They hadn't pre-planned this, sort of not to bore people, but the business side, the advertising side, that kind of thing. But we did have some fun, and we did some great great articles and stuff. I went to New York to interview Bowie, the second of three times I interviewed Bowie, which, you know, are treasured memories for me as a huge Bowie fan.
We have that audio on Roxback Pages. One of maybe three.
Okay.
They all tell you many things, but one thing they all tell you is what a just utterly charming human being.
Charm offensive. Absolutely.
Charm offensive. Yeah.
Offensively charming.
I mean, but do you think it was just a charm offensive? Or do you, because I was actually was genuinely a decent, nice human being.
I always think, even if he had Coco or a helper outside the room the minute before he came into the room going, now, this guy's called Chris or Barney or whoever.
Charm offensive.
And you've met him before. Yes. And he lives in so-and-so. And then, because he would, you know, he would swan into the room and go, Chris, how's Hammersmith? You know, which, I mean, that is smooth.
He could have been a politician, couldn't he?
That really is smooth, you know, because you're immediately impressed. You know, he remembers me, you know.
Yeah.
And I did find him lovely, you know. Another time he came in, I think it was in 1999 when the Hours album was out, and he came in with a cassette, And he goes, "Hi, Chris, I've just been remixing this track 7. I've literally just come from the studio. Do you mind if I play it? Will you hear it with me?" And I'm thinking, I'm the first person to hear this in the world. You know, the teenage me is thinking, David Bowie is asking me if I mind hearing his new...
Yes, yes.
I mean, and
this is a bit too much.
Yeah. But you go away thinking, wow, you know, it's the teenage me is so thrilled, you know. Oh, so
that's lovely.
Yeah, really nice.
So briefly, let's ask you just about when did you first make music yourself? And had that always been an aspiration and a goal?
Yeah, I mean, I've been doing that since teenage days.
Yeah,
and when you asked me, why did I become a music journalist? I suppose I should have said because none of the bands were taking off.
I've never heard that story before.
But then, yeah, I took a sabbatical 1991 because we really liked the stuff I was writing when we were doing under the name Catwalk.
Yeah.
So we had a couple of records out on Dedicated Records at the time with label mates like Spiritualized and the Cranes. I got an unknown guy called Ed Buller to produce them from a demo tape. The things that Ed did after that were the first Pulp records and the first Suede records. So they must have liked something on their Catwalk records. The only track he didn't produce was produced by Kim Deal from the Pixies, who was a friend of mine at the time. So I remain the only British musician ever produced by Kim Deal.
Fantastic.
Which is probably going to be on my, you know, 3 lines for your CV at the end of the day. And great times. I mean, it didn't take off. It wasn't a hit or whatever. You know, got back into the journalism. But I've made other records under other names since then. And yes. I always enjoy doing so. And it satisfies that creative itch.
Yeah. Is there any, like, symbiosis between what you've written about over the years and the music you've made? I mean, do they correspond in any way at all?
I think...
Or things you like to write about?
Probably not. I think I kind of compartmentalise in a way. You know, you do, because you're in a different sort of head.
Yes.
I mean, of course, influences will come in. You know, if you've grown up listening to Bowie and T-Rex, then some of the stuff is going to... Or, you know, but then the second album I made under the name Scarlaland, we were trying to be the Blue Nile and Prefab Sprout, I think, you know, so whatever you're into at that time does kind of filter through a bit, I suppose. Yeah.
How do you find the process of writing music compares to writing about music?
That's a really good question. I think with writing about music, I've become practiced by now, and I know the form. I know when to have my coffee before I start, and when I know exactly how long 1,000 words will take me, 90 right. minutes or 2 hours or whatever, and I know, you know, the formula, because I've been doing it so long. With writing songs, that comes when it comes, you know. It's like you'll be fiddling around on the guitar watching a film on the sofa at night, and something comes, you're like, oh, that's good, or so that drops when it drops.
Interesting. They come, they go. They know what you don't know. They're slow, slow,
quick, quick, slow. The dream will awake. Another just tangent, the first book of yours that I was aware of, I don't know if it was the first book with your name on it, was Idol Worship.
Yes, it was.
It's a real anthology of pieces by Bono, Steve Malkmus of Pavement, Thurston Moore, and Kristen Hirsch and others. And the one that always sticks in my mind is the Malkmus piece we were talking earlier, because I think I did an interview with Pavement around that time and just thought Stephen's contribution to the book was absolutely brilliant. How did you get the idea for that?
HarperCollins approached me. They liked my writing style and they wanted me to do a piece, but also so would I be up for editing, collating these compiling these people, a mixture of musicians and perhaps well-known writers. So Nick Hornby was in there, Martin
Hornby,
Miller, Joseph O'Connor. So we aimed high, and, you know, some names you got, some you didn't. We were amazed when Bono got back, and he phoned me up, and I was living in a pokey little flat at the time, as music journalists do, and the phone rang, and I was just carrying some chips in from the chip shop, and it's Bono on the phone. So you have these surreal moments. Any music journalist will tell you have these surreal moments often where some swanky rock star calls you from the Chateau Marmont, and you're kind of literally changing the cat litter or something. There are always these contrasts.
I thought you were going to say your flatmate said, some guy called Bono on the phone, Chris.
So he was very enthusiastic, fair play, and he wrote this thing about kipping over, getting drunk at Frank Sinatra's house and wetting himself, waking up to find he got so drunk he wet himself on Frank Sinatra's sofa, which is a confession and a half, you know.
That is a confession.
And as you say, Stephen Malkmus wrote a kind of, I don't know, a theoretical postmodern piece about Eddie Vedder and other topics.
Well, that, because that whole idea of like Pavement versus Pearl Jam in some way was a kind of a... Would you just kindly read the subtitle of Idol Worship for us? Because I do love it. I just want to hear it in your...
title of Idol Worship in my dulcet tones is How Pop Empowers the Weak, Rewards the Faithful and Suckers the Needy.
There you go.
Nice.
Doesn't it, but it is a terrific little book. I mean, it's an unusual book in the kind of canon of rock literature.
There's some interesting stuff.
It costs an awful lot now to buy it online.
Does it?
Yeah. Good to know.
You've got a stash somewhere that you can now feed into the market.
Yeah, we could auction them off here in this episode. So at some point you end up on Uncut. Late 90s, 97.
So 97 it launched, yeah, I was involved in the launch, which was the same day that Labour government under Tony Blair were elected, if I remember rightly. That's how I remember the date. So.
Okay. Things could only get better.
I just wanted to ask, you talked about Bowie's Charm Offensive, and so we have another audio of yours with Debbie Harry. I just thought we might listen to that and just ask you about, your experience as an interviewer. So we're just going to briefly listen to this because it's so lovely.
But the curse of... is the now thing, yeah? Curse of Blondie.
Curse of Blondie.
Yeah. Best album you've ever made, you say?
Always. Don't
you? You say that with every album? Right. Mm-hmm. Okay.
With every new album. Oh, that's this one, yet.
Right. Yeah. But this time you really believe it.
You bastard.
You mean it, man.
I've always meant it.
Yeah?
Uh-huh. Being called a bastard by Debbie Harris pretty good, really, isn't it?
Well, was that the first time you'd interview her?
That was the second, I think. The first time would be 89, 90, when Deaf, Dumb and Blonde solo album came out, and I went to New York, and that was about the most excited I'd ever been as a still relatively young, new at the job, going to interview Debbie Harry in New York, which I'd thought was going to be like a Mondrian painting or Boogie Woogie Woogie or a Scorsese film or whatever, Yellow Cabs. It was also exciting. And to meet Debbie Harry in Chelsea in New York was the most exciting thing ever for a kid from Rhyl in North Wales, and she was lovely, and she nearly tripped over a dog as we were leaving the cafe. That memory comes back to mind. She's lovely, but she's very scatty,
she's quite scatty,
as I'm sure you. Yeah. This one was 2003, was it? Yeah, in London. Yeah, the banter there is more over-familiar than I recall. I don't remember being that arrogant and rude to her, but I think it was fun banter. It was, jokey banter. And she likes to laugh, but she's not a raconteur. She's not an interviewee who's a great raconteur like a Tom Waits or whoever. So you have to kind of keep the energy going, But she's delightful. And then interviewed again, I think, 2011 or so.
Well, you put together the Panic of Girls sort of book, didn't you? Because you commissioned me to write something for it, as I recall, in Dim and Distant Past. But I remember it wasn't just an album, was it? It was a whole kind of thing.
It was a tie-in kind of bookazine with the release of the new album that Blondie had linked up with. And that was almost quite nerve-wracking, because you'd have to send it to be approved by Blondie, no writer really enjoys that kind of approved by the artist thing. You want to do your own thing, really.
Did they approve?
Mostly, yeah. 9 times out of 10, it was fine, and it went quite well. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Mm. I've only twice had things to. I wrote liner notes for a Rhino Morrissey thing. He just vetoed them completely. Because that takes a badge of honour. And then I think I had to write Rhino liner notes for one of the really bad Doors albums. I can't remember which one it is. And they just... I couldn't say, okay, it's not Strange Days or LA Woman, but, it's got... there's nothing good about the
song. It's a pretty poor record.
Horrible record. So they ditched
it. It's got a Come On and Touch Me Babe song.
Touch Me Babe.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. It was a big hit. I don't mind Touch Me, funnily enough.
No, but
the
album,
rest of the record is ghastly, pretentious.
It's pretty rubbish. Well, it's not pretentious. It's just cheesy.
But it is really pretentious, too. Yeah, absolutely. My God.
They should have put all of this on the liner notes and then,
would have bought it. They probably did. Yeah. Come on, come on, come on, come on. Now touch me, babe.
Can't you see that I am not afraid? So your Velvet Underground book just came out.
Yes.
Tell us how you got to write a book about the Velvet Underground.
I'd written a book about Lou Reed in 2003, 4, 5, something like that. And
we won't talk about the Lou Reed interview experience. Let's just say it's the opposite of David Bowie and Debbie Harry.
Yeah, yeah, the charm, the opposite of a charm offensive, yeah.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Just a
cross out the word charm. Yeah. Hey, Chris, I fucking hate Hammersmith.
Yeah. He did tell me my question sucked at one point, so yeah, there was that. Yeah, so you started really well, but now you're really boring.
did he want to talk about amplifiers and guitars at great rate?
At times, you had to really work hard to lift him away from that. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it helped that I had interviewed him, because that, you know, helps with the book. You've got some kind of substance to build it on. And the publisher was keen for a Velvet Underground book. I was keen to write that, because I'm fascinated by Warhol and the Factory and Edie Sedgwick and all that kind of scene as well, to bring that in. And, you know, if I'm honest, I was kind of, in the 70s, I was into Lou Reed's solo work because I was a Bowie fan and so forth. Yeah. And so I kind of went retrospectively into the Velvets because I'm so young, you know. But it was more, in a way, it was more like a learning experience to do that, you know, and to delve into that. And it is a fascinating world once you open up that, you know, layers of the onion and so forth. And the whole New York scene. I've always been romantically fascinated by New York of that era. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a wonderful kind of cast a spell on you. And yeah, so it just narrates the story. It's a celebration of them. It then goes a little bit into Lou's solo work, because that's my particular pet area. Celebrates Cale, Nico, who I only ever met when I sat on her coat accidentally backstage at a Pete Shelley concert, and she said, "Get off my coat."
So, on her drugs.
Yeah, well, maybe in the pocket. Yeah. That's why she really, really wanted a coat back.
Now it really makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yes, he's being well received, and run. Yeah,
it seems fantastic. Like the Velvets are having a bit of a moment again,
They always have a moment.
I mean, we've talked about them recently, and, I mean, Jennifer Otterbicker-Dyke's Nico book came out recently, and, like, there's, you know, it's kind of...
I think this stuff is always going to fascinate people, isn't it? There's a wonderful moment where you say to Lou, a lot of people are surprised that you're working with Metallica, and in classic Reed fashion, he goes... Name them. Yeah. Who are these people? Literally, like,
name one.
Yeah, who are they? Name one. He goes, name one.
Yeah. And then he's going, name which website? Which website? You know, has said this.
Yeah.
And then there's a kind of, and this is being recorded for an EPK at the time. So I actually go, this is just ridiculous, isn't it? There's a level. So I go, can we cut? Can we take this again? Because this is obviously an awful way to start. At which point.
That's how it started.
That was the first, gambit. Which kind of, he kind of cracks a smile and goes, you know, to let on that he's kind of, okay, I'm playing up to the Reed parody, you know, self-parody. And then he's pretty much a pussycat after that. But yeah, he said himself, I think, in an old Alan Jones interview, that he loved the idea of Lou Reed, and sometimes he played the character of Lou Reed, you know, and who wouldn't be attracted by playing this, you know, extremely romantic, fascinating, mercurial, maverick.
Yeah, no, well, I mean, I completely agree. Sort of appalling human being, but a genuinely artist.
You know, he's married to Laurie Anderson now. She's a wonderful, interesting artist.
And a really lovely person.
And by all accounts, a really lovely person. Yeah. And so I suspect there is a Lou Reed that he would not let us see, who's an absolute sweetheart. But he wasn't going to let us...
In later years, I would think so, he mellowed. And I think at the end of this interview, I recall, it was all finished and the cameras were off. And I went closer and you realised how frail and kind of elderly he was at the time, you know, because from this far with the lights and the cameras, you just see the myth of Lou Reed. But close up, it was the last couple of years of his life, and he really was quite frail and papery, and he very soft spoken. And then he was very kind of, yes, I'm playing Hammersmith next week, and, I do hope you can come. And he turned into this kind of more civil... No longer playing the role, you know, behind the curtain kind of vibe, which made me warm to him.
Right. No, it's interesting. It's interesting,
And an abrupt sort of change of theme, there are two albums that are turning 25 round about now. And the first of them that I thought we'd just talk about briefly is Missy Elliott's debut album, Super Duper Fly.
What a record.
What a record. What a woman. You reviewed it, Chris, for...
apparently.
Melody Maker. And you said her debut album, you give some context to her because you know that she has been writing and, like, producing the Aaliyah hit, I think, I think that's already been a hit, One in a Million at that point. I may have got the chronology wrong. Mm-hmm. But you say her debut album is something else, managing both the soulful and the futuristic with such aplomb that it's either visionary or wonderfully accidental. And then you say at the end, Old Soul Hounds... there were a couple we'll be sucked in by the recent hit, a radical sci-fi take on the Ann Peebles classic I Can't Stand the Rain, which was just called The Rain, wasn't it, on Super Duper Fly. A slave to rhythm which bullishly reinvents the dead art of dub. The rest is rootless, refreshingly unique and unbridled. Do the hustle. So you liked the record. your take on Missy at that point, and what a kind of, you know, breath of fresh air she was. Do you remember when you first
heard her? Think it was that the mix of that, as I said, the soulful and the futuristic. She was using the material of soul's history and recent history, and they were making something, herself and Timbaland were making something new out of it and futuristic. Yeah. And it did become the kind of the future of pop music. Little did we know then how much this kind of sound, you know, kind of stripped down minimalist beat would come to dominate.
The other thing that was fascinating is that they were aware of stuff outside of what you'd regard as what they're normally listening to. So, I mean, Bangra and things like that are lurking in the language of her stuff. And, I mean, that's so interesting, hearing stuff which actually you're more likely to hear in Southall than you'd hear in the Bronx, for example.
Yeah.
You know, creeping into what they're doing. We all love that record.
I think it did turn out to be visionary, not accidental as it happens, which is great, because I mean she's still making good music. I mean, she appeared on Lizzo's album a couple of years ago, and it was kind of like she hadn't put much out, but suddenly it was like that single wasn't really a Lizzo single; it was a Missy single, and she was just there to kind of say, "I was here."
Yeah,
I'm still here, and I love Missy.
But you know, the amount she contributed, as you mentioned about writing for Aaliyah and people like that, she had been writing and producing for some way before she herself had hits, and she carried on doing that even when her hits stopped. She never stopped contributing to other artists' stuff.
Yeah,
she's great.
Yeah,
she's absolutely great.
She became one of those names shortly after that, one of those names that it was hip to have on your...
Yeah.
Featuring Missy, it became a kind of a must-have...
Absolutely.
...have thing. And then you do sometimes get a bit of a diminishing returns when you become that name to be tagged on. But her, you know, her best work is great, of course.
I mean, she talks about I Can't Stand the Rain. The track that really grabbed me from the off was Sock It To Me, which takes the Delphonics' Ready or Not, Here I Come. And what Timbaland does on that, the rhythm that he constructs for that, I it just takes my breath away. I listened a couple of days ago to a podcast that she did with Rick Rubin, you know, Rick Rubin's Broken Record podcast, and it's a really lovely conversation. She's delightful in it, but she's really interesting about, I mean, so we talk about like accidental versus visionary. There are definitely some accidental elements in the way Tim, so apparently Tim, who she calls Tim.
Yeah, Timothy. I wonder if he said, don't do that again.
Yeah. They've only had some quite cheap Casio keyboard. I don't know whether this was when they were first working together. And he just accidentally kind of selected this kind of barking sound, you know, when they were first working together. And he loved it so much that things like those sort of bizarre sounds that Timbaland would work in came from that moment where he just thought. And, I mean, I think things like, you know, the Justin Timberlake, Cry Me a River. I mean, sounds on that are just extraordinary. I mean, I really do think he's... what is Timbaland doing at the moment? He sort of doesn't seem to be quite as prominent a name in R&B or hip-hop.
I don't know. I mean, it was so dominant for I want to say 15, 20 years because the waves of it influenced other artists to come. And I wonder if it kind of was partly responsible for guitars going away for a while or, you know, and pop, the British pop charts certainly became, the top 10 would all be Timbaland influenced or Missy influenced, yeah, sure, whether they were good or bad versions of, mm-hmm,
it. Yeah.
It really became the dominant strain.
Yeah,
definitely.
I really loved even the second album, which I noticed has a bit of a bad rep, Dareal World. It was very sort of cold and futuristic and sort of cybertronic kind of sound, but I still think it was really good. Didn't sell that well. And then she came back. Am I right to say she came back with Get Your Freak On? I think.
I'm not sure. It's so long ago.
Which
I
was
can't
just
remember.
Like, that's the sort of Bangra thing. And I mean, Get Your Freak On was just like, it's the most radical thing I've heard in like 5 years. Hit banger. Hit me. Hit me. Now people gather round. Now people jump around. Just fantastic. And she's just such a...
And musically she's great, and lyrically she's great. She's very funny, she's very witty and clever with it. And her flow is great. The way she raps is just so influential as well.
And, you know, it's a terrible thing to say, but the way she presents herself, her physicality, is good and important.
Oh, yeah.
She, room for the larger woman. At a time when the dancers of this world were sort of taking over... It was
she definitely wasn't a diva.
She wasn't that, sing like a diva, but she just didn't present herself as, because she presents herself as she is.
Yeah.
It's a time when body fascism was becoming such a thing.
Definitely.
It was really important.
In both literal and metaphorical senses, she took up the space that she wanted to take up.
Absolutely.
End of story, which I think is
fantastic.
Brilliant,
And that influenced who could be a pop star, who would be a pop star.
And someone like Lizzo is a direct sort of,
absolutely.
Without whom, exactly. That's right, I agree. So, on to the second album.
Which has got nothing to do with it.
Which is not influenced by Missy Elliott. I don't think. Who knows? I mean, Timbaland might have had some influence on Radiohead. OK Computer, probably the most famous record. We have added our very first audio interviews with Radiohead. So I am going to ask Mark to tell us about the first of them.
Well, we're putting up two and we're going to switch from one to the other. But the first one is R. Robbins on the phone to Tom and Colin Greenwood, Tom York, Colin Greenwood, in May 93. So it's pretty early. They'd just had Creep had just been a hit. Pablo Honey had just come out. That's what they're promoting. And, they're frightfully articulate young men from sort of posh schools in the Oxford sort of regions and are very amusing, very interesting. We'll play a clip. Why have I got clip two written there? Anyway, play a clip. This is some... Tom Collins.
It is clip two, yes, because clip one was Chris Roberts. Was some guy called Chris Roberts.
Being abused by someone. This is them talking about star quality.
What the fuck is star quality anyway? Everyone keeps bloody talking about it. All it means is star quality means you're trying to live out someone else's kind of myth or legend and stuff. It's really pissing me off that all the things that have been written about this recently, because they're all sort of angling on this. He definitely wants to be a star sort of thing, which is kind of... Well, what does that mean?
I think star quality sort of English music press is basically not being too controversial about certain things, like mentioning other bands and slagging them off. Being controversial about flavour of the month topics, like sexuality.
Uh-huh.
And also having a certain dry humour and sense of irony, being able to be witty off the cuff.
It sounds like you've got this pretty well sussed.
For God's sake, you think of musicians, people in bands, the most important thing is to write good songs and play well. It's not to become chat show host, Arsenio Hall type people.
Well, it's playing some sort of Shakespearean role or something. It's public school. Well, sorry, you got us on the... Oh no, Papa's dead, long live Pop. It died an ugly death
by back catalog. I love the idea of them talking about Shakespearean roles.
Yeah, public school crap.
they talk about the band's, image, and that's all part of that. About recording, because it was a relatively new experience to them at that point, going to recording studios. They talk about the meaning of the Pop Is Dead single. We'll play a clip at the end of the podcast where Tom particularly talks about Creep and lyrical scrutiny, about sort of having the words... I mean, because they've got very fed up with creeping in. They said, oh, God, we're always that creep band. Yeah, and sure. Like that.
I love the fact, what he said, I just wanted to ask you, Chris, but that moment where he says, you know, this is how you present yourself as a kind of, you know, pop star or rock band to the music press, and you know you're not too controversial about this, and you've got kind of, you know, you don't slag other bands off too much. I mean, do you remember when Radiohead at that moment, you know, around Pablo Honey and Creep, do you remember what the general reaction to them was in the context of the music scene?
I think Pablo Honey before the Bends, that kind of time, they were generally perhaps just seen as another good up-and-coming indie rock band. You know, I don't think anyone predicted they were going to turn into Radiohead.
No.
Show your respect. Yeah, I don't think anyone knew that was going to happen. But they were very, very good. I remember going to see them at the Garage, which, for people who don't know, is a small place in Highbury and Islington. You know, maybe 300, 350 capacity.
Yeah.
And you could, you know, I remember going right to the front with my pint and probably my cigarette if it was 1992, 93.
Yes, when you could.
But being able to wander down the front, and it was kind of, they were just, it wasn't like Radiohead were not the, you know, the gospel, you know, tablets that they are now. But they were very good. They're really good, I will say. You know, if I remember how I felt then compared to how perhaps my opinion has changed over the years, I really enjoyed them. They were terrific. They were tight. They were energetic. They were playing the songs from the Bends before it had come out. Terrific live band. And then when I went to see them sort of maybe, you know, a few years later, once they'd become capital R Radiohead, it was very solemn and the audience were very chin scratching shushing each other, and you must be earnest and you must look at the levels of meaning and all this.
Yeah.
And that was a less enjoyable experience.
Yeah, so I always loved the sound of them. I love the guitar players. And I just became increasingly sick of Tom York and his pain. And I never saw them live at that time, but seeing them on television on stage. And there's sort of this man endlessly going to kind of crucifix poses, and you're thinking, just fuck off. But I love the guitar players in that band. I think they're really I still think they're really interesting sonically.
I mean, the rock star thing is strange, because on one level I think I do want my rock stars to be rock stars.
Yes.
I want them to be larger than life and flamboyant, you know.
Yeah.
But then on another hand, I can kind of see what he means. Why should a rock star know any more about politics or whatever than the guy working in the corner shop, you know?
Yeah.
But we miss proper rock stars, pop stars. Big mouths were great fun.
they're very funny in the sense of you're talking about Tom's loud guitar and about how on stage that he had always had this kind of Fender Twin turned up full, and then ended up just taking tubes out of his Fender Twin to cut his volume, and he didn't even notice. That's that. And the second interview is Phil Selway on the phone to Jim Sullivan, the Boston Globe in 97. They're on the OK Computer tour, talking about significant recent events, doing Glasgow, and so basically what you're just describing, them becoming superstars rather than just another good indie band. Well, let's listen to this. This is them on hit Phil Selway on finishing OK Computer.
With OK Computer, I mean, you guys obviously took a risk in terms of making a very ambitious record, and one that isn't, you know, as obvious, perhaps, and one that's where there are definite rewards, but they take a little time to work for. Did you know that when you were making it? Was that, did you come to that kind of realization at some point?
I don't think we actually came to that point until the album was finished and it was actually sent out to... it was actually handed over to the record company. I think up to that point, because we'd been shut away pretty much on our own for the better part of a year, so we were, when we were responding to the music, we're responding in a way that we either like that, find that interesting, or no, that doesn't really work. But there weren't any other considerations beyond that, I think, for us. But having said that, you know, suddenly it came out of that very claustrophobic situation into the full light of people's comments on it. Right. And that was very worrying at the time. It was quite frightening, really.
Quite frightening, really.
So well spoken, these Radiohead chaps. Interesting to hear that, though, because obviously, you know, at that point, OK Computer doesn't have the kind of status that it has now. And we know more about, I mean, he uses the word claustrophobic. So, you know, we learnt about how they kind of hold up in Jane Seymour's, you know, Jacobean mansion, right, outside Bath for like, you know, months, like bands used to do, right, in the 70s. And
it's given home is just up the road in Oxford. It's not exactly kind of massive no. trek.
No, it's
all good for Sunday lunch with mummy and daddy.
Oh, you bastard. I mean, look, I will declare, I think OK Computer is a masterpiece. I think it's an extraordinary record, one of the great like British rock records. So I will stand by that. I loved it from the moment I heard it. I think Nigel Godrich is an incredible producer. Another reason to talk about them is that Godrich is now back in there. So there's this new record by The Smile, which is just, they've released a number of tracks already to Spotify, etc. And Godrich has produced that. It's basically Tom and Johnny, probably the two kind of key members in a way. But I mean, I would ask, so we've added to the homepage, along with your Missy, a review. You may have been talking about this earlier, this review you did at the Royal Festival Hall.
Around about 2000, did it?
Just before Kid A is about to come out. So it's an interesting, you know, moment to sort of witness the transition from OK Computer into a much more kind of electronic and techno version of Radiohead. But, I mean, you're not very flattering about OK Computer. Like you utterly dismiss Paranoid Android, which I love. I think it's ridiculous.
You're a fight. You think.
I would draw that. I wouldn't say. I don't think I'm like a Radiohead hater at all. I don't think I was that sort of antagonistic. I think I mainly in that review was talking about the audience.
You do, yes. You're very funny about
the
audience.
It's a funny thing to judge a band by its audience, but it can happen when you get that kind of...
I just felt like I was going to be being scolded if I moved.
Yeah,
you know?
Right. Yeah. It's an interesting problem, though, for a band that starts out as such a good live band to then, you know, how do you capture that on your first record? And then if you achieve that, how do you ever move on? Because at some point you're not going to be that new indie band who everyone wants to go and see it in a 350 person venue, and and if you keep trying to make that record again and again, you're not going to really progress artistically or otherwise. And so then how do you navigate that? And then they're obviously all keen and creative musicians and want to explore different things sonically. So I think they actually, even if they maybe lost a bit of the live magic or whatever it was, they did successfully kind of bridge that gap of like, well, where do we go from here, basically?
Oh yeah, and I think for their audience, for their devotees, they were still a wonderful live act and still are to this day. You know, if you went with them on that suspension of disbelief or whatever journey. Yeah, no, I just found it all a little bit earnest, you know, but I'm not a Radiohead hater at all. I can kind of, I like some tracks, I don't like other tracks, you know.
I'm kind of in the same boat, actually.
In a table debate, that's a really boring position to come from. But
Jasper is from Oxford, so he has a bias inherently.
No, I mean, I wouldn't characterise myself as a huge Radiohead fan, actually. I mean, I like some of their music. I mean, one of my favourite albums is A Moon-Shaped Pool of their work. I think that was a real return to something, some true feeling, which really resonated with me after kind of not having been so into them. Although, as I've trotted out before on this podcast, I am on In Rainbows clapping as a child, which is quite entertaining because they came to my music school as a kid.
True.
But no, I mean, there are other Oxford bands that I like better and that I think still do that raw live energy in a really powerful way, like Foals, for example. You know, for me, that's going to be more engaging if they're a guitar band, and there are other things that I like more if it's going to be electronic sounding. Yeah. So, you know, I'm kind of in the same boat as you. There's stuff that I really like and stuff that doesn't really do it for me. Yeah.
This is probably a very appropriate moment to play the next clip because it's actually Phil Selway talking about them being seen as der git, kind of appropriate.
Yes. Why not?
I can
can see why people think we're a bunch of dour gits, actually, but when you look at the press and the photographs, I mean, we're not a smiley bunch, really.
You're not a smiley bunch, no. Okay.
And, you know, I mean, also, I mean, to a certain extent, when people home in on Tom, I mean, they do tend to produce a very caricatured version of him as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's inevitable with all bands. All band members come across as caricatures of a certain side of them anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel quite, I suppose we do feel quite distanced from that.
I'd actually like immediately after that to read a bit from that review, which, because I think it's really nice. There are spells where all this "we are in the presence of God" stuff is penetrated, where things stop being an unintentional parody of U2 scraping their earnest nadir before ricocheting back to inspiration. Tom's voice does do things, unholy, angelic, demonic things, which force you to see, to hear, to feel his pain or someone's. I get that. At the risk of sticking my neck out, Radio have something.
There you go. What a profit.
I really agree with that in the sense I there is something profoundly irritating about Tom York, but I also think he's an incredible singer and
an incredible singer, songwriter. Yeah.
You know, I really do. He has written, I mean, it's not just OK Computer, things on like Hail to the Thief, I think are just sort of combination between his sort of lyricism and Johnny's just like, well, let's call it.
I think
genius.
Johnny's a great foil to him and a fantastic composer in his own right as well.
I agree. I think he's the most interesting thing about the band, but then again, you know.
He's certainly the most musically talented, there's no doubt about that.
But he's clearly got a series of references, which is way outside normal rock and roll for a start. You know, that he's got an interest in, like, avant-garde composers and so on and so forth. It's right from the beginning, it's there.
Sure, that's
the thing.
Yeah.
And also just as the way he plays guitar is close to some extreme sort of avant jazz sort of person in a way, or Sonny Sirocco, one of those sorts of guys. Which is I personally find really interesting.
But I think in a way, I mean, the bigger picture story is that Radiohead did react against being a sort of rock band, you know, not an indie rock band anymore. They were on, you know, Parlophone, and Kid A really was sort of kicking against that prick. It was like, we are, you know, we are not just a guitar-based rock band, and they have done a lot of, I think, pretty interesting things.
Do you think there's an analogy with Blur?
Vaguely.
The Blur sort of, again, reacted against this sort of narrow box of being, you know, a Britpop band, and actually kind of went further and further up.
Sure.
And I think, and I'm not a huge Blur fan either, but I think Blur became much more interesting around the time of the album Blur and so on.
Well, and you look at things like Gorillaz and the Marley music stuff, got involved, Band, the Ugly Tone.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they very much did not kind of rest on their laurels, I would say. I mean, I'm not as big a fan,
and they're all on Parlophone.
Yeah, there was another group that was on Parlophone that constantly reinvented themselves, wasn't there? From the 60s. Cheeky Chap from Liverpool.
I think it's safe to say that I'm much more support, you know, a Radiohead or a Blur experimenting, trying new things, as opposed to an Oasis doing the same modern thing over and over.
Definitely on that side of the divide. We can all coalesce around that.
You don't like something. If someone's trying to do something, that is in itself admirable. Particularly at the time when everyone's sounding the same. And when I think, you know, you were at the coalface as a music writer in the 90s when there's something, this massive bands came out of this country, most of whom were sort of undistinguishable from one another.
It's going to be interesting, isn't it, in 25 years, how many Britpop bands will still be spoken about. It'll probably just be Blur and Oasis with supporting roles for Suede and Pulp.
But Pulp aren't really a Britpop band.
They weren't really,
at the time.
And Blur had certainly been something very different before Britpop.
Are you listening? Any of you listening to Book of the Week, which is Jarvis Cocker's thing? It's interesting. I don't think it's probably quite as good as everyone wants it to be, because we all love
it. This is his memoir.
Yes. Yeah. And we all kind of love him. It's okay. It's I made Full Curtain.
Good Pop, Bad Pop is a great title.
It's good. It's very good.
That's enough for me. Isn't it?
Also, for the Book of the Week, he actually played like the very first demo they recorded. He plays it on the radio show, and that is pretty fantastic. Anyway,
I remember Pulp from the 80s. I mean, Fire Records used to send me Pulp records.
And this is what, 86, 80? Way back.
And I can't say I love them. I would kind of play this new Pulp 12-inch and sent to me and just think, I always struggle to get past this sort of non-voice, you know,
we probably need to have a serious podcast discussion about Pulp. Maybe you should hold fire until then.
Hold Fire Records. Well, that does bring us to the end of that section. We're just now going to talk about what's new in the library. And Chris, as we always say to our guests, if you hear the name of something that just sparks a kind of memory, just jump in.
Right.
Wave your arms frantically.
Or just start talking.
Start talking over us.
That'll work. Yeah, the great Maureen Cleave, The Evening Standard in 64. The Ronettes are visiting England, so she meets the Ronettes, which is great. And Estelle, the others say, is the sophisticated one. She doesn't like the same guys we do, Ronnie said. Estelle agreed that she certainly did not. I like the guys over here, she said, on the motorcycles and black jackets and tight pants. She was a rocker. Estelle Ronette was a rocker. I love that.
I mean, they did have affairs with quite a few British musicians, I believe.
There have been the tour bus.
That's
the
right
point.
Yes. Good for them.
Well,
good
I mean, all the, you know, the British musicians must be good grief. Oh, these glamorous women from New York. And it's like, oh my God!
You've never seen anything.
Just
like
imagine it. You must hear John Lennon's jaw hitting the floor from here.
John Lennon's tongue hanging down to the floor.
John mailed Kevin Swift Beat Instrumental 67. And this time when John Mayall's band held one after the other the leading lights of the British blues guitar explosion. But first of all, he's talking about John McVie, who became famous as part of Fleetwood Mac, is the Mac in Fleetwood Mac. He says, John McVie is the best blues bass guitarist in Britain or America, as far as I'm concerned. He's been out of the band twice for being drunk and disorderly, but he's very, very good. And I think in that period when he was drinking, he was frustrated because the band wasn't playing as it should be. Other way of describing him as drunk and disorderly, which is actually was a criminal offence.
That's what justifies him kicking him out of the band.
But then it's very healthy for us when Eric Clapton obviously went, because this adulation thing was getting ridiculous. We were pulling in the wrong kind of people. Young fans would come along just because of this God thing. As an Eric Clapton
is a bit of a purist, perhaps. Male.
Certainly was. Lillian Roxton, this is fantastic. Sydney Morning Herald, 1969, reporting on the Stonewall riot. And this is reported a week after the riot.
Wow.
Was it covered in English press? Quite possibly not. But here we are, Sydney Morning Herald, the wonderful Lillian Roxton. And she meets this one redhead. If the Queens of America ever get together, said one redhead, aiming her stiletto heel with vicious precision, it's the end, baby. We've had enough. I just think it's marvellous to have something about Stonewall written the week after it happens on the site.
That's really great, that. Love that.
Moving on to Sounds 81, the wonderful Sandy Robertson interviewing Purple Blues Florian Frick. Florian Frick, you'd be able to pronounce that better.
Florian Fricke.
Thank you. Our native German speaker.
Correspondent.
He says, a great German actor has said that Herzog can only work with dwarves, crazies, freaks and Klaus Kinski. Probably about
this is Werner Herzog,
right?
Not a sort of keyboard player in Purple. How do you pronounce Purple, though?
I was going to stand back and that you pronounce it.
Until we get the computer.
It's not really a German. I mean, if you were saying it in German accent, I might say Purple. I don't know. I don't know.
You're absolutely right, because it is very German, peculiar. So I don't mind being nasty. Leaping forward to 1997, 1997 is quite a long time ago now. This is a guy called Gerald being interviewed by a new writer who got on board, Emma Warren, very pleased about. I wrote a lot for Jockey Slug. And he says, have you got a national insurance number? That's your number. Bill Gates is on a mission to make a one-world computer system. 1997. 25
years
ago.
Another anniversary. Spreading conspiracy theories about Bill Gates.
I mean, just a couple more things. This week is Pete Johnson, the LA Times, reviewing the impressions at the Whiskey in 1967 in Los Angeles. Well, first of all, it's lovely to get a live review of the impressions from 1967. He says, their sound is smooth and rich without being slick. The polish of years of performing has not made them insensitive to their material. The impressions are not as flashy an act as are their Motown competitors. There are no intricate dance routines or acrobatics with microphones, but their stage presence and sure singing ability make them an excellent performing group. Just very, very pleased to have that in the library.
The impressions. I saw the impressions.
Wow.
Did you?
Live. Not
with Curtis. No, but not with Curtis?
Yes. It was a reunion. I don't know if it was a tour or just a few shows that they did at the Hollywood Bowl. I went with Harvey Kubenick and our mutual friend Denny Bruce to see. I think it was billed as like Curtis Mayfield, Jerry Butler, and The Impression. So the set comprised three different segments.
Yeah.
Solo Jerry, solo Curtis. Yeah. I mean, it was just magical, even though they were obviously... quite a few years older than they had been when Pete saw them. But I mean, just the harmonies were still.
I mean, we love that. So when I was with my band, we had Timmy Helms and those guys, so our backing singers. And at one point in rehearsal, I started playing I'm So Proud, and these three guys started singing it. And it was one of those just glorious moments, you know.
There's nothing quite like the human voice. Together with other human voices.
But then you've got Curtis's guitar behind that. And without Curtis's guitar, like Hendrix, all of Hendrix's ballad style is basically Curtis Mayfield.
Prettier than all the world. And I'm so proud.
I'm so proud.
I'm so proud.
So I'm going to lower the tone now. Ray Parker Jr. has been interviewed by Michael Goldberg from Rolling Stone 84. He says, some girls would just take their clothes off and say, let's get it on. You have to resist. You have to be strong. That's my love.
Can you get a call?
Exactly.
Yeah. Can I call someone? They're taking their clothes off. What do I do?
We'll send someone round.
Resist,
Ray. Resist. Because you're spot on. This is 84, so it's exactly his Ghostbusters.
Exactly the time when he stole the Ghostbusters theme from Huey Lewis.
Who? Oh. But no, he turns around and says, we both stole it from M, pop music.
Huh?
He says that's where we both stole that riff from.
Hilarious.
You mentioned, I can never.
So he says that in this interview because the Huey Lewis thing comes up.
Huey was trying to sue him.
It's not wise to say where you stole something.
But he just turns around and says, look, we all steal everything from everywhere, you know, which was his point. But he's actually right. Pop music is.
Where do you stand on stealing?
Well, I quite fancy these microphones, so if you
look at not what I meant, Chris.
I think there's so much out there in the ether now, so many notes and melodies that, you know, there's only... How would you come up with something that no human being in all these thousands of years has ever come up with?
So you're not going to take Ed Sheeran to court.
But on the other hand, if it's a ka-ching on possibility. No, I mean, I think we're reaching the stage where everything has been done and it's what you do with it, I think.
Yes, I mean, I totally
agree.
And then also, of course, the use of sampling sort of changed the landscape in terms of how you can appropriate things now and to make them your own. But then again, you listen to My Sweet Lord by George Harrison and it is...
The chiffons,
you know, note for fucking note. So, you know...
And they won that, of course.
And they won that.
Whereas the guy who took Sheeran to court did not.
Mm. I've never heard what that was, so it's impossible for us to tell.
You're going to get some chances, though, aren't you? You're going to get someone who, you know, well, my song says, oh, yeah.
I think it's a difficult line to draw because on the one hand, you say, well, yes, a lot of stuff is out there and, you know, how are you going to come up with something new? And on the other hand, you don't want someone who is already, like, number one pop star in the world to get to just...
Yeah, you're right.
Appropriate.
Steal from inappropriate stuff from those who are further down.
And then you have a problem with bands like Led Zeppelin, who ruthlessly stole left, right, and centre. I mean,
they would put their names on the credits of stuff that's written by Willie Dixon and so on and so forth. Mm. And I never heard the Randy California track, which is Stairway to Heaven's intro. And apparently it is absolutely note for note. I haven't actually personally heard it.
I don't know about note for note. I had to interview Spirit once and right. I had to do all the surviving members and had to listen to it a lot. And I would say maybe 55%. You know, it's not note right. for note, as people say. Yeah. But
they had been touring with Led Zeppelin, so to come across... Anyway,
I think it depends a bit on intent and it depends a bit on your attitude as to when... If someone says, well, you know, were you influenced by this? You ought to own up to it and you ought to kind of... You know, say, well, this is what we're doing. And then if there is something, like with samples, you probably should pay that person for the use of them. You know, it's kind of, it's difficult because on the one, you don't want to restrict creativity, but you also don't want to kind of just make it a free for all. Because when it is a free for all, the same people hoard all of the power and acclaim and everything.
So I mean, well, what about, you know, there's that Bittersweet Symphony, which is the
Lou Goldham
that's right.
orchestra Stones thing, yeah.
And the thing is that there's two such completely different items that, you know, but they end up having to give all their publishing to the Stones.
They did, I know. I remember Robert Plant saying to me once on this issue that he was, I don't know whether he and Jimmy were going to a press conference or something, and Jimmy sort of goes to Robert, well, what if they ask us about ripping off, you know, the old blues guys? Robert said, just keep walking. Well, words to that effect, just keep walking.
Oh, God. Anyway, so that's my lot for these
What's
two
What's your lot, Jas?
My lot, I'm going to start with an interview with Fallout Boy by Stevie Chick in The Guardian in October 2008. I believe our colleague Tony added that recently, so thanks, Tony.
Thanks, Tony.
It's actually a very funny interview. I mean, make what you will of Fallout Boy's music, but Pete Wentz, frontman of Fallout Boy, appears near comatose, resembling the fictional rock star Hot Black Desiato from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, who spent a year being dead for tax reasons. Had to get that in because I'm such a huge fan of The Hitchhiker's Guide. But he says, I feel like the last person who should be giving advice to anyone about anything, Wentz says of the fans who deluge Fallout Boy's website with desperate pleas for help. I think part of it is we're living in the age of the internet. If it had been around back in the days of The Smiths and The Cure, I'm sure people would be writing to their website asking, oh, Morrissey, I'm so depressed too. What should I do?
the days of The Smiths and The Cure, can you imagine? And Morrissey is a sort of agony uncle. He's not really who you would choose.
Not really. Next up, Grandmaster Flash breaks down Netflix's new series, The Get Down, Alan Light and Mother Jones in July 2016. And Baz Luhrmann obviously got Grandmaster Flash to consult on a bunch of that series. And it's just a fascinating interview if you're interested in the early days of hip-hop and the technology that was involved, because, you know, Grandmaster Flash was very involved in the invention of scratching and all of that. And there's a funny bit where Alan Light asks, what was the hardest part of consulting on this series? And Grandmaster Flash says, after a month or two, Baz says, Flash, I'd like to make you a character. I says, hell no, I'm not going in no film. He says, no, I want a young Flash, someone to play you. 2 months later, I meet somebody that looks like I made him. What's your name? He says, Mamadou. I've been hired to play you. I want to learn everything about you. And Alan Light goes, the kid really does look like you. And Grandmaster Flash says, I actually asked him, what's your mum's name? I didn't know it, so I was like, thank goodness.
It's just great. Did you watch The Get Down?
The pilot episode.
Right.
Yeah.
I
enjoyed it, really. I don't know. I'd have to go back and watch the other episodes to give a definitive verdict. But I like the idea of it, and I like that someone's going there.
I mean, what about saying you did interview Grandmaster Flash? I think that we've got he's tagged.
Various MCs and so forth, but not.
It's so Baz Luhrmann.
Yes.
I mean, I'm curated that exhibition at the hospital about the first 10 years of hip hop. You know, I kind of dived in there.
Yeah.
And I watched this, and I found, I mean, I like Baz Luhrmann's movies are fine, but they're so camp and so extravagant.
Mm.
And this reproduction of the Bronx as some glittering golden world where beautiful women step out of ruined buildings and sort of then dance on cars. But then that's
sold.
Yeah, well, exactly. but that's the problem. I'm the wrong person.
It's too romanticized.
Well, no, but then again, I can see how great that is, but just not for me.
It is a little bit
pastiche. It's terribly pastiche.
But it's like a Roxy Music idea
It is very well researched. It does get a lot of the details right because he spoke to people like Grandmaster Flash. If you want to know the story, is him? He goes into why he decided that he wanted to even mix records together. I was annoyed with the way DJs were playing. The part that would get people dancing the hardest would be the drum solo, but the rate was always like 10 seconds long. I was like, what the fuck? Yeah. I have to be able to make one long song of drum solos. So he starts researching needles, elliptical, spherical, torque theory, how long do you need to take the record off the platter.
From what I understand is he was the first guy to use the 1200, the tenth turntable, because it had the best torque.
Yeah, it had the best torque.
He didn't invent scratching. That was Grandmas of Theodore. Well, I love the story. Grandmas of Theodore has got his hand on a record and his mum's banging on the door saying, turn it down. He kind of leans under the door and his hand moves the turntable and he hears it. And it's like, Flash did something which is forgotten. He used to go to disco, proper disco stuff. He saw disco DJs. And there's guys like Pete DJ Jones and all these guys doing mobile discos in Brooklyn primarily. Way before sort of hip hop inverted commas, and they were doing that. They were queuing up records and doing all sorts of stuff. So and he saw that they were using mixers. He built his own mixer. So he glued sort of disco technology to what Cool Herc had done, which is playing the breakbeat over and over again.
He says then mixers. I need to be able to hear the mix before you do. That's when I came up with the peekaboo system.
Yeah.
And then there was a problem. A new turntable had a mat like a big rubber pancake. Too much drag. And so then he goes out and buys sort of bits of fabric because his mother was a seamstress, and he then irons together these bits. He hits it with spray starch and irons it and creates what he called a wafer, which allowed him to make to do this quickly. It's a great piece.
Yeah.
It's a lovely interview. So
that's lovely.
That's that. And then lastly, I just wanted briefly to mention our first piece about Nigerian German singer Ayo, who is a kind of neo-soul singer-songwriter. And she's from Germany with, Nigerian background. And I happen to really like her music. And I wanted to mention it also because she actually mentions Missy. There was a time when I was listening to French hip-hop. I liked I Am and Joey Starr from NTM. My favourite group was Cyan Supercrew. At that time when I was listening to them, I didn't know the day would come when we'd actually become real good friends. I really enjoyed the flow, the freshness of the French rap. Then, of course, MC Solar, when he did the song with Missy Elliott, All In My Grill. I really enjoyed that because it was like a new blend, a sign that music doesn't have boundaries. Which really speaks to what you were saying earlier about how Missy would go and just take influences from anywhere. And I think it's great. And Ayo makes kind of mixture sort of neo soul and folk, different influences. A real singer songwriter, and has a really
some
nice voice.
In the office, old bastards like Barney and I just sort of.
And that was Miles Marshall Lewis speaking to her in Essence magazine a couple of years ago. So.
Some people say that I'm too open. They say, it's not good to let them know everything about me.
Well, that's a nice way to end the episode. It remains for all of us to thank you so much for coming in, Chris.
Such a pleasure.
A real delight.
That really was huge fun.
Yeah, so more power to you.
Pleasure and an honour.
Good luck with the Velvets book and future publications.
Which is getting rave reviews. So left, far, so right, good. And centre.
Yeah, I'm very, very grateful. And I'm sure my 15 minutes is on its 14th minute.
the clock is ticking.
Let's enjoy it while it's
What I'll do to say, Chris Roberts will enjoy 15 minutes of fame at some point in the future.
He also predicted that the 14th 15. Minute he would come on the Rocks Back Pages
he
podcast.
Did. He said that.
Yeah. In 14 minutes and 22 seconds.
we're going to go out with a clip of Tom talking about Creep. But on that,
that's the plan.
On that happy note.
Thanks so much, Chris. It's been really great.
Yeah.
Pleasure. Absolutely.
So we have definitely come to the end of the episode. Please review the episode on Apple Podcasts and other platforms if you feel so inclined.
Yeah, we really appreciate the reviews. It really helps get the podcast to more listeners. And so
it'd be nice to kind of get one which counterbalances that one on Apple Podcasts, which talks about this ghastly false laugh that a certain contributor to Rock's Back Pages podcast has.
Yeah, so if you could post that you laugh Mark Pringle's laugh, we'll pay you. All right, so this is me and all of us saying goodbye to you listeners.
Bye.
Bye.
I read that Creep is about a real person, but that you were sorry you had ever mentioned that.
Yeah, I still am. I mean, in some ways, it's good to say it because it gives people a context, but on the other hand, it's a shame that people need a context for it. If they like the song, then that should be enough, I think. I think people should write it their own way, in their own head.
But the song is in the first person, so, I mean, if it's about a person, it's more like, I mean, is it you in the person of somebody else?
Yeah, always.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just how I write, really. I mean, I went through the whole phase of sort of writing wee songs. But it's kind of really stupid, you know, because, like, well, and sometimes it works.
But, like, in that song, when you say I, you don't mean I, Tom, you mean I, the person that the song's about.
Yeah, but it's very difficult to distinguish, and that's kind of the point, if you know what I mean.
I wish I was special. You're so fucking special. But I'm a creep. I'm a
That was Tom York in conversation with Ira Robbins in 1993, concluding this week's Rock's Back Pages podcast. Many thanks to special guest Chris Roberts. His new book, The Velvet Underground, is published by Palazzo and available now from all good bookshops. The hosts were Barney Hoskins and Mark Pringle, and it was co-hosted and produced by Jasper Murison Bowie. The Rock's Back Pages podcast is part of the Pantheon Podcast Network. You can find thousands of articles, as well as hundreds of full-length audio interviews, at rocksbackpages.com.
But I'm a creep. I'm a